This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with The Week magazine of April 3rd. U.S.-Iran clash over Trump's claims of peace talks. President Trump claimed that very good and productive talks with Iran were underway, even as elite U.S. combat troops were dispatched to the Persian Gulf and Iran denied it was engaged in negotiations. "They want to make a deal so badly," said Trump, who asserted that envoy Steve Witkoff, son-in-law Jared Kushner, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and Vice President J.D. Vance were all engaged in talks that had yielded points of major agreement. But Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, said no talks had taken place and that Trump was using fake news to manipulate the financial and oil markets and escape the quagmire in which the U.S. and Israel are trapped. The administration sent a 15-point plan to end the war to Tehran, under which Iran would dismantle its main nuclear sites, suspend its ballistic missile production, and end its blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, a channel in the Gulf through which 20% of the world's oil was shipped pre-war. Iran publicly rejected the plan, which was delivered by Pakistan. But the New York Times reported that behind the scenes, some Iranian officials were considering meeting with U.S. negotiators in Pakistan next week. The wrangling followed a threat by Trump to obliterate Iran's power plants unless it reopened the strait within 48 hours. Trump, who a day before issuing the threat had said the war was winding down, backed off as the deadline neared, citing productive talks. Iran's foreign ministry called Trump's about-face a bid to reduce energy prices and buy time for implementing his military plans. As Iran continued to exchange missiles and drones with the U.S. and Israel, the Pentagon ordered up to 3,000 paratroopers from the 82nd Airborne Division to head to the Middle East. The directive came as three warships redeployed from Asia approached the Gulf, carrying some 4,500 sailors and Marines. U.S. officials said the troops could potentially be used to seize Karg Island, Iran's main oil export hub, or to reopen the strait by seizing parts of Iran's shoreline. Trump suggested a deal could be struck for the strait to be jointly controlled. Asked by whom, Trump said, "Me and the Ayatollah, whoever the Ayatollah is." Trump backed down from his obliteration threat after Arab allies warned him of the dangers of following through, said Ben Bartenstein in Bloomberg. They said the destruction of Iran's energy infrastructure would almost inevitably result in a failed state on their doorstep and that Iran would strike back against oil and natural gas facilities across the region. Trump, whose approval rating has sunk to 36% in a new Reuters Ipsos poll, had another motivation: calming markets rattled by his threats and the ongoing conflict. He issued the reprieve just before the start of U.S. trading. The S&P 500 then rebounded and the price of Brent crude dropped sharply. Trump was so spooked by spiking energy prices that he made another concession, said Andrew C. McCarthy in National Review. This one utterly indefensible. His administration lifted sanctions on 140 million barrels of Iranian oil, which will yield Tehran about $14 billion, money that will fund its combat operations against the U.S., Israel, and U.S.-friendly Gulf states. The administration claims the move will lower global crude prices and give the U.S. more time to topple the mullahs. In reality, all it does is reveal that Trump will make valuable concessions to our enemies if they disrupt financial markets and harm his poll numbers. "This whole war is an exercise in hollow absurdity," said Jacob Bacharach in New York. Why are we fighting? What is the end game? With no coherent answers, we are left with the weird machinations of a would-be despot who seems to operate entirely on his whims. Part of Trump's problem may be his information diet, said Catherine Doyle in NBCNews.com. Sources say that each day aides show him a 2-minute video montage of the biggest, most successful strikes on Iranian targets. Amid the triumphalist message, some allies fear he's not receiving or absorbing the complete picture of the war. Let's dial back the panic, said Brett Stevens in the New York Times. The war's going better than you think. In less than a month, we've crushed the military capacity of a hostile regime and decapitated its leadership, and we've done it with no naval losses and the deaths of only 13 personnel. Compare that with the 23 personnel we lost in the 1989-90 invasion of Panama, whose military phase lasted a few days. Any negotiations to end the war face daunting odds, said Lawrence Norman in the Wall Street Journal. Both sides have maximalist demands, with the U.S. insisting on unfettered passage through the strait and zero nuclear enrichment, while Iran wants full sanctions relief, compensation for the war, and removal of U.S. bases in the region. But if both sides want an off-ramp, there are ways to get there, perhaps a pause in enrichment and a drawdown on sanctions to be phased in as Iran frees up the strait. Other issues could be kicked down the road. Trump's military adventure has reached a dizzying impasse, said Edward Luce in the Financial Times. So certain of a quick victory, he lacked a plan B. He's now tossing out wild threats and claims of diplomatic breakthroughs and seeing what sticks. But the one thing Iran will never agree to surrender is its ability to disrupt the global energy markets, which is the one thing Trump must have. Amid the torrent of feints, hype, invention, and bluster, it remains disturbingly unclear how Trump will find a way out of this morass. DHS gets new boss as ICE heads to airports. Former Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, Republican of Oklahoma, was sworn in as Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security as lawmakers struggled to reach a deal to end a weeks-long DHS shutdown that is causing chaos at major airports. The Senate confirmed Mullen by a comfortable 54-45 margin after he sold himself as a more pragmatic alternative to his ousted predecessor, Kristi Noem. But the partial government shutdown has left his department with no new funds since February 14th, and around 90% of the DHS workforce has been working without pay. Only ICE and Border Patrol workers are still getting paychecks, and only because they were funded out of last year's big, beautiful bill. Senate Republicans suggested ending the shutdown by funding most parts of DHS through a bill that would require Democratic support and cleaving off ICE funding to bundle it with other priorities Democrats object to, including increases in military spending and new voter ID requirements. They hoped to pass these later as a budget reconciliation measure, which is immune to a Democratic filibuster. Democrats, predictably, nixed the idea outright. At airports, thousands of unpaid TSA agents have called in sick, and nearly 500 have quit altogether, with waits at security lines topping 3 hours at some major hubs. President Trump ordered ICE to deploy its agents as extra hands, even though ICE agents are not trained to operate TSA X-ray scanners. The crowds at New York's LaGuardia Airport, where a crash between an Air Canada Express jet and a fire truck killed 2 pilots and wounded dozens, blocked investigators from the National Transportation Safety Board from getting to the scene. They had to beg to be let through, said NTSB Chair Jennifer Homendy. It's been a really big challenge to get the entire team here. Deploying ICE to airports is a stunt, not a policy solution, said the Washington Post in an editorial, and has produced little besides social media images of camo-clad agents idling in terminals. Note that these extreme delays are not happening in the 20 U.S. airports that are allowed to use private contractors to perform TSA screenings. We should clearly expand that program to avoid future airport snarls. For now, though, the quickest solution is to fund DHS. The Republican plan would have gotten partway there by resuming paychecks for employees of most of the department's agencies, including the TSA, the Coast Guard, and FEMA. Democrats had plenty of reason to balk at the GOP proposal, said Aaron Blake in CNN.com. Treating ICE funding separately would have robbed them of their ability to insist on reforms that appeared to be quite popular, including restrictions on agents wearing masks and raiding churches and schools. That, after all, was their original rationale for the shutdown, which grew out of their outrage at ICE's killings of three Americans. Plus, they point out, it wasn't just ICE involved in the violent crackdowns in Minneapolis and elsewhere, but also Border Patrol and other Homeland Security agents. They have everybody at DHS right now doing immigration enforcement, said Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut. So by funding any part of the department, you're providing money for immigration enforcement. Yet under Mullen, such enforcement might be less confrontational, said Dace Potas in USA Today. The new DHS secretary at least speaks the right language. He pledged that his immediate goal for DHS was to ensure we're not in the lead story every single day, a blessed change from gnomes showboating. The Trump administration is trying to signal a more moderate approach, said Erica D. Smith in Bloomberg, having abandoned the phrase mass deportations. Still, Mullen is an immigration hawk who has repeatedly backed Trump's crackdown in cities and called undocumented immigrants federal fugitives. Worse, he has no experience running anything beyond his family's plumbing business. Everyone will have their own views on what should or shouldn't change about U.S. immigration policy, said Margaret White in the Detroit News. But holding the American people hostage is not a responsible or effective way to implement them. Spring break travel season is here, and millions of us are disgusted and outraged at seeing our airports, TSA officers, and all of us reduced to bargaining chips in a partisan game. Lawmakers need to get in a room now to resolve this and not leave until they do. Energy shock. How bad could it get? It's not easy to topple a $30 trillion economy, said Alicia Wallace in CNN.com. But if the war in Iran keeps driving fuel prices higher, things will soon start getting dodgy for America. With Iran's blockade of the Strait of Hormuz stopping the export of oil from many Gulf Arab states, and missiles and drones raining down on oil and natural gas facilities across the Middle East, the International Energy Agency warned that the world is facing the biggest energy crisis in history. The U.S. is already feeling the shockwaves. Oil has rocketed by roughly 30% to about $100 a barrel. Gasoline has hit a national average of over $3.98 a gallon, up by $1 since February, and is over $5 in California, Washington, and Hawaii. Understandably, some 45% of Americans say they are extremely or very concerned about gas prices, according to an Associated Press poll. For a first glimpse of where we may be headed, look at Asia, said Alexandra Stevenson in the New York Times. In a region that relies on Middle Eastern energy, gas stations in Thailand and Vietnam are posting sold-out signs. People in India are hoarding cooking gas. Asian airlines have canceled thousands of flights after the price of jet fuel more than doubled, and all of this only after 1 month of a conflict with no clear end in sight. The war is also driving the world toward a food crisis, said Heather Stewart in The Guardian. Hormuz is a key choke point in the global supply of urea, a nitrogen-based fertilizer that's made using natural gas and sulfur, a byproduct of oil and gas refining, and another critical fertilizer ingredient. Once farmers get hit by the double whammy of higher energy bills and more costly fertilizer, it could push some 45 million people around the planet into acute hunger, according to a UN estimate. Americans won't starve, said Max Zahn in ABCnews.com, but they will pay more for everything from groceries to smartphones. A third of the world's helium travels through the strait. That gas is essential for the production of microchips used in phones, AI servers, and almost all electronics. The chaos in the Middle East is also pushing up the cost of plastics, which are made of petrochemicals and aluminum, because the region is home to several key smelters. There is some good news for Americans, said John Cassidy in The New Yorker. Thanks to decades of tightened emissions standards, so detested by President Trump, our economy is far less energy intensive than it used to be, with every dollar of GDP created requiring only half the energy it needed back in 1980. As long as the war ends soon, many economists think the U.S. can probably scrape through this year without a recession. It's already too late, said The Economist in an editorial. Even if fighting stopped today, it would take at least 4 months for oil facilities in the Middle East to restart production and process backlogged crude into usable fuel, and for markets and prices to regain some semblance of normality. And that's a best-case scenario, said Roger Karma in The Atlantic. If fighting escalates, instead, Iran could reach for the doomsday option it previewed when it responded to an Israeli strike on its largest natural gas field by attacking a Qatari facility that produces 20% of the world's supply of liquefied natural gas, causing natural gas prices to spike 35% in Europe. If there are more such attacks on energy infrastructure in the target-rich Middle East, our current energy crisis may become a global economic catastrophe that we'll be living with for years. Yuma, Arizona. Heat dome. A historic heat wave embroiled large swaths of the southern U.S., with at least 14 states breaking March temperature records. Arizona, California, and Nevada all witnessed temperatures at least 9 degrees above average, with highs reaching a smoldering 112 degrees in both Yuma, Arizona, and Winter Haven, California. In Phoenix, temperatures were in the triple digits for 5 consecutive days, and Denver and Albuquerque topped 90 in what is already the warmest March on record in the United States. The heat dome was blamed on weakened jet streams causing weather patterns to stagnate. It has contributed to the worst flooding in 2 decades in Hawaii, where rescuers saved 233 people, and historic wildfires that raged across the Great Plains. In Dawson County, Nebraska, the Cottonwood Fire engulfed over 125,000 acres, while residents in 2 Colorado counties were evacuated. Lawmakers there warned federal officials to prepare for what could be a catastrophic fire season. New York City runway disaster. Federal investigators were zeroing in on a string of communication and technical lapses that contributed to the fatal crash between an Air Canada jet and a fire truck crossing a runway at New York's LaGuardia Airport. The inbound plane from Montreal was landing at around 11:40 p.m. when it slammed headlong into the vehicle, which was responding to another emergency. The collision was so violent that the nose of the plane crumpled inward, killing the two young pilots, and a flight attendant was ejected from the plane while strapped to her jump seat. She was expected to recover. More than two dozen passengers were hospitalized. Initial reports found there were two air traffic controllers on duty, though one was performing dual responsibilities, which is not unusual during overnight shifts. It's unclear why the tower granted permission to the truck to cross runway 4 while the plane was approaching 100 feet from the ground. But only seconds later, the controller implored the vehicle to brake. "Stop, stop, 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 Truck 1, stop, stop, stop," the controller said. It's unknown whether those inside the fire truck heard the orders while other vehicles behind it stopped. LaGuardia has runway status lights embedded in the pavement that turn red when a runway is in use, which the truck should have heeded. Also being probed is why the truck was not equipped with a transponder that allows airport controllers to track locations of vehicles in the area, which National Transportation and Safety Board Chair Jennifer Homendy said should be standard. 15 minutes after the crash, a controller told a pilot he had tried to prevent the collision. "I tried to reach out to him," he said, according to a recording, adding, "I messed up." Palm Beach, Florida. Backyard Blues. Democrat Emily Gregory became President Trump's new state representative after flipping the Florida district that is home to Mar-a-Lago, invigorating Democrats' hopes for the midterms. Gregory, a first-time candidate who campaigned on affordability and public health, handily defeated Republican John Maples in a district that Trump won by about 11 points in 2024. Trump voted by mail for Maples, despite saying mail-in voting should be banned, and promoted him at a Palm Beach event. Another Florida Democrat, Brian Nathan, also won a state Senate special election in a major upset, while Boca Raton elected its first Democratic mayor in 45 years earlier this month. Nationally, Democrats have flipped more than two dozen seats since the 2024 presidential election. "If Democrats can win in Trump's own backyard, we can win anywhere," said Democratic National Committee Chair Ken Martin. The World at a Glance. London. Anti-Semitic attack. Vandals torched four ambulances outside a Jewish charity in London in what Prime Minister Keir Starmer called a deeply shocking anti-Semitic arson attack. Nobody was injured. The ambulances were parked near a synagogue and operated by Hatzolah, which provides EMT services in the largely Jewish neighborhood of Golders Green. Harakat Ashab al-Yamin al-Islamiyah, a newly emerged group linked to Iran, claimed responsibility for the attack, as it has for similar anti-Semitic attacks this month in Belgium, the Netherlands, and France. A Golders Green resident told the London Times that people fled their homes as oxygen tanks in the vehicles exploded, sounding like bombs going off. Paris. Socialists prevail for now. The left won local elections in France's biggest cities, but the far right made gains in many smaller cities. Socialists held onto the mayorships of Paris, Marseille, and Lille. "This message is clear. Paris is not and never will be a far-right city," Paris mayor-elect Emmanuel Grégoire said after winning with a boost from Greens and Communists. The far-left party France Unbowed also did well, especially in working-class Paris suburbs, but Eurosceptic, anti-immigration national rally, which leads presidential polls, won in 30 smaller towns as it continued to build grassroots support, and it scored an unprecedented win in Nice, France's fifth largest city. Havana, shameless request. The Cuban government rejected a request from the U.S. Embassy in Havana to allow it to import diesel fuel for its generators during an island-wide blackout caused by a U.S. oil embargo. The Cuban government called the U.S. shameless for demanding the very fuel it denies the Cuban people. Cuba has been struggling to restore power since its national electricity grid collapsed, leaving millions of people in the dark. Since toppling the leader of Venezuela, Cuba's primary oil supplier, in January, President Trump has blocked all oil deliveries to Cuba and now says he expects to have the honor of taking over the communist-run island soon. Deputy Foreign Minister Carlos Fernandez de Cossio said the country was ready to mobilize in case of invasion. We would be naive if we do not prepare. Copenhagen, Denmark, protecting Greenland. Denmark made preparations in January to blow up Greenland's airfields if necessary to prevent a U.S. invasion, Danish public broadcaster DR reported. President Trump has been escalating his threats to seize the semi-autonomous Danish territory by force, posting that month that the U.S. wouldn't be secure unless we have complete and total control of Greenland. Denmark then rushed a military mission to Greenland with medical supplies, including bags of blood, to treat anticipated casualties, as well as explosives to damage runways so that U.S. forces would be unable to land. Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen's firmness in standing up to Trump helped her Social Democrats win a slim plurality in this week's elections. Moscow, spring offensive. Russia unleashed one of its largest aerial attacks of the war against Ukraine, hitting Kyiv and other cities with more than 1,000 drones. Ground forces also began a spring offensive in the east. Ukraine escalated too, launching its largest drone wave yet into Russia and Russian-occupied Crimea. The Kremlin has cut off cell service in much of Moscow, ostensibly to foil the Ukrainian drones, but Agentsvo, an independent Russian exile news site based in Europe, reported last week that the shutoff is actually aimed at protecting Vladimir Putin. The Russian president has stopped going to the Kremlin and canceled all public engagements as a security precaution. He is said to be spooked by reports that Israel targeted and killed Iran's Ayatollah Ali Khamenei by hacking traffic cameras and tracking his bodyguards. Home, Iran. Post-protest executions. Iran hanged three young men who'd been arrested in the January protests in what human rights activists fear could mark the start of a wave of executions to stifle dissent during the war with Israel and the U.S. The young men, among them star wrestler Saleh Mohammadi, 19, were accused of killing two police officers during the mass uprising against the regime. Iran's regime controls the justice system, and Mohammadi told the court he had confessed under torture. Dozens of the 50,000 people arrested in the protests have also been sentenced to death, and many more could face the same fate. Iranian state media have aired footage of hundreds of detainees confessing to capital crimes. Amnesty International said Iran used disappearance, incommunicado detention, and torture to extract forced confessions. People. Kudrow's comedic evolution. Lisa Kudrow could have spent her career in a laboratory, said Michael Shulman in The New Yorker. Growing up in the San Fernando Valley, she showed a natural talent for comedy and acting, entertaining her friends with impersonations and bonding with her older brother's best friend, John Lovitz, over a love of performing. But in high school, she gave up theater for biology, thinking she'd become a doctor like her father, a leading authority on cluster headaches, and brother. When she arrived at Vassar College in the 1980s, she was thrilled to be among East Coast intellectuals. Everyone thought I was an idiot because I was smiling all the time like a California ditz, says Kudrow, 62. In college, her focus shifted to evolutionary biology. Still, whenever she'd watch The Late Show with David Letterman, she'd note how phony his celebrity guests sounded. All of a sudden, the thought was, "Okay, Lisa, when you're on Letterman, just be yourself." Then I'd think, "Wait, why would I be on Letterman? For an evolutionary theory idea?" After graduating in 1985, she worked at her father's California clinic assisting in headache research. But when Lovitz was cast on Saturday Night Live that same year, she realized she didn't want to have any regrets later and decided to join the Groundlings, a comedy improv troupe. Her parents were delighted. They went, "Thank God, maybe this'll lighten you up and then you can meet someone." Rubio's rise. Once derided as Little Marco, Trump's 2016 primary rival is now a power player in his administration. How influential is Rubio? As the first official since Henry Kissinger to serve as both Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, the 54-year-old former senator is the most powerful foreign policy voice in the White House in decades. An executor of President Trump's America First doctrine, he has presided over the dismantling of the U.S. Agency for International Development, fired hundreds of foreign service officers, and revoked more than 80,000 visas, many belonging to foreign students in the U.S. who had criticized Israel's war in Gaza. He played a key role in planning the January raid that captured Venezuelan strongman Nicolas Maduro and was later tasked by Trump with helping to run the country. Rubio's MAGA ascendance is in many ways unlikely. Battling Trump for the Republican presidential nomination in 2016, Rubio savaged his current boss as a con artist and made insinuations about Trump's manhood by referencing his small hands. A skilled political operator, the man Trump once dismissively nicknamed Little Marco, has since ingratiated himself with Trump, who regularly lauds him in public. "When I have a problem, I call up Marco," Trump said in May. "He gets it solved." What is his background? He was born in Miami to Cuban immigrant parents whom he for years described as exiles, suggesting they arrived in the U.S. after Fidel Castro seized power in 1959. In 2011, multiple outlets uncovered records showing his father, a bartender, and mother, a hotel maid, arrived in the U.S. 3 years before the Castro-led revolution. Still, his family's immigrant story and staunch anti-communist beliefs became a key theme in his political career. Elected as a city commissioner in West Miami in 1998, the University of Miami Law School graduate won a seat in the Florida House 2 years later. Rubio impressed GOP colleagues with his drive and became the chamber's first Cuban-American speaker in 2006. Elected to the U.S. Senate on a Tea Party platform in 2010, he focused on national security. While running for president, he vowed to spread economic and political freedom, bolster alliances, and resist despots who subjugate their smaller neighbors. He ended his presidential campaign in 2016 after Trump crushed him in the Florida primary. How did he become a Trump ally? When Trump retreated to Mar-a-Lago following his 2020 defeat, then-Senator Rubio began building bridges with his former foe. The pair spoke regularly on the phone, and as Trump prosecutions and scandals mounted, Rubio went out of his way never to criticize the president publicly, said one Rubio associate. When Trump ran for president again in 2024, Rubio gave an early endorsement and began wooing Trump's children. Since becoming Secretary of State, he has loudly defended the president's policies and lauded his boss. Trump is standing up for America in a way that no president has ever had the courage to do before, Rubio wrote on X after Trump lashed out at Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in an explosive 2025 White House meeting. The administration is a snake pit, but Rubio just seemed to be a little better at navigating it, a former administration official told Politico. He's also proved remarkably malleable in adapting his views to the MAGA agenda. How has he changed? Having demanded in 2022 that President Joe Biden boost funding for USAID to counter China's rising global influence, Rubio last year oversaw its dismantling, calling it an agency that long ago went off the rails. A one-time champion of immigration reform and human rights, Rubio brokered a deal to send 250 Venezuelan migrants to El Salvador's brutal CICAT prison, where inmates have reported torture. Some former colleagues are appalled by the shift. Rubio's MAGA brain transplant is complete, said Senator Chris Van Hollen, Democrat of Maryland. But some lawmakers and diplomats insist that, behind the scenes, Rubio acts as a restraining force. Is there evidence of that? Rubio intervened on Ukraine's behalf last November when White House Special Envoy Steve Witkoff was pushing a ceasefire deal that Rubio reportedly condemned as a Kremlin wish list. After Rubio inserted himself into U.S.-Ukrainian negotiations, the deal was revised to account for Ukraine's red lines. And when Trump threatened to grab Greenland from Denmark this year, Rubio quietly reassured European leaders. He's doing his best to moderate Trump's worst impulses, a European foreign minister told The New Yorker. But in other instances, he's fueled Trump's aggression, pushing for the removal of Venezuelan strongman Maduro, whom he'd long denounced as a narco-dictator, and for an almost total embargo of Cuba. The stunning 10 out of 10 success of the Maduro capture lifted his capital with Trump, said University of Florida foreign policy professor Patrick Holm, and boosted Trump's confidence in his ability to impose his will abroad. You could draw a direct line from the Maduro raid to the Iran attack. What does Rubio's future hold? Another White House bid is near certain, say observers. The question is when. Vice President J.D. Vance is MAGA's heir apparent, and he dominates Rubio in early 2028 polling. The Secretary of State has pledged to back Vance if he runs, and associates say he might hold his fire for a later run. But ABC News recently reported that a group of Republican donors is quietly exploring ways to boost him as a 2028 contender, and Trump has repeatedly floated Rubio as a possible successor. He has been privately polling advisors and friends about the relative merits of Vance and Rubio, according to media reports, and shown increasing fondness for the Secretary of State. At a recent dinner for 25 donors at Mar-a-Lago, he asked the crowd whom they wanted, Vance or Rubio. The verdict, one attendee told NBC News, was almost unanimous for Marco. Best columns of the U.S. The Iran deal that Trump ruined. As President Trump takes the country deeper into a costly, unpredictable conflict with Iran, said Suzanne Maloney in the New York Times, let's not forget that he tore up the deal that was designed to prevent a war. In 2015, President Obama reached an agreement with Tehran with the help of several European allies, China and Russia. The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action imposed stringent restrictions on Iran's nuclear activities, backed up by inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency. Obama acknowledged that the deal didn't resolve all our problems with Iran, but he argued that the only alternative was a major Middle East war. For several years, the JCPOA succeeded in limiting Iran's uranium enrichment, but Trump withdrew from it in 2018, insisting he'd force Tehran to sign a more stringent deal. He failed. In fact, the angered Iranian regime accelerated its enrichment program and amassed 970 pounds of uranium enriched to 60%, not far from bomb grade. In killing the Iran deal, Trump undertook a decision of immediate strategic consequence without a viable alternative. So now the president, who returned to office promising to avoid wars, has stumbled into one he doesn't know how to end. Why universal health care isn't viable? Medicare for all is back, said Ramesh Ponuru in the Washington Post. And it's still a completely impractical idea. Several Democratic Senate candidates and gubernatorial candidates are reviving the proposal to have the federal government administer a national health care program for every American. Democrats have never generated much support for universal health care and won't have an easier time selling it now. Proponents admit national health care would cost upwards of $1 trillion a year and require major tax increases on the middle class. Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders argues that savings on insurance premiums and deductibles would cancel out higher taxes, but voters won't trust that promise. Countries with national health care systems pay doctors and hospitals far less than they're paid in the U.S., and care is rationed with waiting times of months. Is any of that politically feasible in the U.S.? National health care would also require kicking more than 200 million Americans off employer-provided insurance and individually purchased policies. Would most Americans willingly give up their existing coverage for a new government-run system of unknown cost and quality? Democrats are on the verge of learning again that the answer is no way. A new void in vaccine guidance. The U.S. no longer has an official vaccine policy, said Catherine J. Wu in The Atlantic. A federal judge ruled that Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. likely broke federal law when he fired and replaced all 17 members of the CDC's expert vaccine advisory panel with fellow anti-vaxxers. In the ruling, the judge also invalidated all of that panel's new policies on childhood vaccines and other preventative shots, saying its arbitrary and capricious decisions were not based in solid science. The Trump administration indicated it would appeal, but a legal battle will leave vaccine policy in a kind of purgatory for months or longer. The nation has never been so suddenly stripped of its vaccine advisors with no backup plan. It's unclear how the CDC will make recommendations on annually updated vaccines for the flu and COVID, or on any new vaccines. Medical groups, most doctors, and Democratic states' health officials all continue to strongly recommend childhood and other vaccines, but polls show that Kennedy has deepened vaccine doubts and fears, especially among Republicans. Americans, in effect, have been left with all too many options for whom to listen to about vaccines. Israel, can the war lead to lasting peace? The conflict with Iran is proving that the Islamic Republic poses a clear and immediate danger to the entire region, said Roy Binyamini in Yediath Ahronoth. Iran has hurled missiles and drones at every Gulf Arab country, Kuwait, Qatar, Oman, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates, even hitting oil and gas facilities. The Arabs now see that their defense and security goals align squarely with Israel's. That's why Israel should seize this moment to leverage its experience helping Gulf partners strengthen civilian defenses. By closing the Strait of Hormuz to oil traffic, Iran is projecting the image of a neighborhood bully not to be challenged. Israel, though, is not just challenging the bully, but winning. A victory over Iran could have more Arab states to join Bahrain and the UAE in the Abraham Accords, normalizing relations with Israel. That would leave us in a much safer neighborhood at the end of this war. Only if we defeat Iran decisively, said Eyal Vered in Makor Rishon. Israel has long been loath to obliterate our enemies, fearing that to do so would make us the bad guy. But refraining from an act of absolute victory rests on a weak, dangerous, and morally distorted conception of good. Letting an evil regime live to rebuild and fight again is what the Allies did after World War I, and the result was World War II. Having learned their lesson, they therefore demanded unconditional surrender from Germany and Japan. Israel learned a similar lesson after the October 7, 2023 Hamas massacre. Now we know that evil regimes like Hamas and Iran must be overwhelmed with full force until they surrender, and that this is the most moral thing to do. We'd better hope we can achieve a total overthrow of the Ayatollahs, said retired General Itzhak Brik in Ma'ariv. If Iran loses the war, but its regime remains intact, it will eventually regain its military capabilities with help from Beijing and Moscow, and then its fury will know no bounds. It will seek help from nuclear states, North Korea and Pakistan, to turn its uranium stockpile into 10 atomic bombs. Every one of them will be aimed at Israel, the state it has sworn to eradicate. Military campaigns launched without a clear political endgame, as this one was, rarely produce stability, said Gershon Baskin in the Jerusalem Post. We will get something from our suffering and spending in this war if it leads to both the disabling of Iran's military capabilities and a rapprochement with our Arab neighbors. But while Iran's attacks have helped push those countries toward us, having a common enemy is not enough. For Arab governments, normalizing ties with Israel and creating a shared security framework are contingent on Israel's making credible progress toward resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That won't happen under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has spent his career trying to render a two-state solution impossible. But it has to happen if we are to have a peaceful existence. If the political situation after the war looks exactly like it did before the war, or worse, the region will have paid an enormous price for very little strategic gain. Iran war, Europe's futile efforts to stay out. President Trump's war against Iran is a war of choice, and it's one that Europe did not choose, said Sylvie Kaufmann in Le Monde of France. Trump tried to drag Europeans into it with his peremptory demand that NATO help reopen the Strait of Hormuz, a vital oil route. But European leader after European leader said no, pointing out that Europe's war is in Ukraine. That Europeans dare to refuse a U.S. request is a major development for a continent that has tended to follow America's lead. Trump is not used to that, and it's driving him mad. In a social media post, he said NATO members were cowards, and we will remember. But Europeans are busy with their own war, the one to expel Russian invaders from Ukraine, the one that is actually a war of necessity, and they are in no mood to risk blood and treasure for a Trump administration that has done nothing but abuse them for a year with transatlantic diplomatic torture, such as arbitrary tariffs and an effort to snatch Greenland. At this point, Trump's repeated threats to withdraw from NATO have lost their sting. Yet, we can't pretend this Middle East conflict will pass us by, said Anne McElvoy in the Eye paper of the UK. Iran's recent targeting of the joint US-UK Diego Garcia military base in the Indian Ocean, more than 2,000 miles from Tehran, means that its ballistic missiles may be able to reach Berlin, Paris, even London. That was a wake-up moment for sleepy Western leaders who ignored Israel's warnings about Iranian capabilities. Iran's shocking expansion of the potential war zone has rendered any wait-and-see approach moot, said Dominic Johnson in Taz of Germany. Britain has responded by giving Trump the green light to use British bases to secure Hormuz, and France could well use its newly established outpost in Kenya to patrol the Indian Ocean. With the Iran showdown definitely coming for at least some European countries, it's not so easy to claim this is not our war. In fact, there is currently no European we. Every nation must decide for itself where it stands in this looming Third World War. We are part of the conflict whether we join the military fight or not, said Michael Bachmuller in the Süddeutsche Zeitung of Germany. Europe has made itself a casualty of two wars, Ukraine and Iran, by failing to shake its fossil fuel dependence. When a conflict closes an oil or gas route, our economies plummet. Yesterday, Nord Stream. Today, the Strait of Hormuz. You'd think these twin shocks in rapid succession would jolt us into a greener path, that the EU would race to switch to renewables. Instead, a disastrous mechanism has been set in motion. Rising oil and gas prices don't just make it attractive to switch to more efficient alternatives. They also incentivize fuel companies to develop new sources of oil and gas. Germany's energy ministry is now considering taking up fracking for natural gas, which would only cement our dependence. But if Europe doesn't grab this opportunity to go green, it will be hit by another shock the next time there is a conflict in the Middle East. And there is always conflict in the Middle East. Obituary. The respected FBI chief who investigated Trump, Robert Mueller, 1944 to 2026. Robert Mueller began his term as FBI director on September 4, 2001, just a week before the 9/11 terrorist attacks that refocused the agency's mission. A decorated Vietnam veteran who'd spent years prosecuting major cases as a U.S. attorney and earned a reputation as a by-the-book lawman of the highest integrity, Mueller knew right away that the Bureau faced a new era. Over a 12-year term under Republican and Democratic presidents, he expanded its focus from domestic crime to thwarting terrorism. 4 years after that term ended, Mueller became a household name as the special counsel investigating ties between President Trump's 2016 campaign and Russia. Issued in 2019, the resulting Mueller report found numerous links between Trump's team and Russia, but stopped short of declaring a criminal conspiracy. Trump said the report was the work of Trump haters. But pursuing justice was Mueller's only lifetime motivation, said biographer Garrett M. Graff in 2017. He might just be America's straightest arrow. Raised in a stately manor outside Philadelphia, Muller was born into privilege, said the New York Times. He attended the elite boarding school St. Paul's, where he captained the hockey and lacrosse teams, and then went to Princeton. Upon graduating, he volunteered to join the Marines and led a rifle platoon in Vietnam, earning a Bronze Star and a Purple Heart. He then studied law at the University of Virginia and became a federal prosecutor. Stationed in San Francisco and then Boston, he rose swiftly through the ranks and in 1990 headed the Justice Department's Criminal Division, where he oversaw winning prosecutions of Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega and mob boss John Gotti. Tapped by George W. Bush as FBI chief, he built a reputation for nonpartisan rectitude and stone-faced reserve, said the Washington Post. When the Bush administration proposed to extend a secret wiretapping program on U.S. citizens, he threatened to resign, and Bush backed down. As special counsel in the Trump investigation, the tight-lipped Mueller maintained his old-school button-down style as he led a probe that riveted the nation, said the Associated Press. In the end, he brought charges against six Trump associates, but his nebulous report, which left to Congress the question of whether Trump obstructed justice, did not deliver the knockout punch Democrats had hoped for. Still, Mueller did explicitly refute the president's claim that there was no substance to the Russia investigation. Absolutely, he said, it was not a hoax. The karate master who became an action star, Chuck Norris, 1940 to 2026. Chuck Norris knew exactly what his audience wanted. A six-time world karate champion, he also had black belts in taekwondo, tangsudo, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and judo. When he pivoted to films, he chose warrior roles. Showing up to save the day in movie after movie, he won millions of fans, even if he never quite won over the critics. This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.